Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about officer-involved shootings. Police shot and killed around 1,000 people last year. The shooting last fall of a Bad River teen by an Ashland County Sheriff's deputy has ignited debate over how law enforcement respond, their training, and what, if anything, can be done to prevent such shootings. Late last Friday, a special prosecutor announced that Officer Brock Marjanovich would not face criminal charges in the death of 14-year-old Jason Puro. We want to warn listeners that the story you're about to hear may be difficult for some.
Shots fired. Two shots fired. He wouldn't drop the knife. Came at me. Two shots fired. I need EMS now.
That's Ashland County Sheriff's Deputy Brock Marjanovich. The officer shot and killed 14-year-old Jason Puro on the Bad River Reservation in November. Special Prosecutor and St. Croix County District Attorney Mike Niskus reviewed findings from the Wisconsin Department of Justice and said the officer's actions were, quote, justified by the circumstances he found himself in. The DOJ said the deputy shot Puro after the teen lunged at the officer with a knife. Niskus said the investigation shows Puro called 911 from his home phone.
I was wondering if you could send a police officer over to my house. There's a guy walking around with a knife outside my house.
Okay. And what's your name?
Jason.
Jason, what's your last name?
Puro.
A knife found at the scene was consistent with those in Puro's home. The state's findings also show the teen had a number of what appeared to be self-inflicted cuts and the powerful opioid fentanyl in his system. Ashland County Sheriff Mick Brennan declined to comment on the state's findings, but his office released a statement urging people to read the report. The statement went on to say his office is committed to restoring trust with the surrounding community. Last Saturday, community members and Jason's family protested the prosecutor's decision along U.S. Highway 2 in Ashland, including the teen's older cousin, Curtis Gauthier. He said he wants to see healing.
The feeling of safety for my children, for everybody in this community, a rebuilding of trust for everybody in this community as well.
Do you think would rebuild trust between the community, like the tribal members and law enforcement?
Just more working together, getting together, understanding of historical traumas, things of that nature, understanding of the hurts and abuses everybody in both communities carry, and just to work together to find ways to for us all to grow and heal from incidences like this. Whether it be any number of things as far as treatment, community gatherings, you know, simple things like that. Creating ties with each other, bonding in that capacity.
What do you want to see happen next, then?
Truth. I want the absolute truth in all of this.
So you don't agree with what the state has come out with their findings?
I don't agree that there's any justification for a shooting of a young man. There had to have been other avenues to take to resolve the situation. I just don't think it had to be nobody had to die. There could have been something else, other ways to resolve that.
Jason's cousin, Danielle Delgado, was also there holding a sign that read, "Justice for Jason." She and her mom, Renee Puro, have a hard time believing the state's findings about Jason's death.
I don't believe any of it.
Excessive force was not necessary.
I totally agree. It wasn't necessary at all.
What do you want to see happen now moving forward?
Should I answer that? I mean, obviously I want to see justice, you know what I mean? Like, I want to see this guy have some kind of punishment.
You want to see the officer face?
Some kind of punishment. I don't think letting him back into work is right after what he did. Like, he's on paid leave and then he gets his job, gets to go back to work. I don't think that's right.
All I really can say is I think the excessive force wasn't necessary. You know, he had a taser on him. He had pepper spray.
He could have called for backup.
He just acted so quick. You know, he was so quick to bring the gun out and shoot. And I don't believe that that was right.
In the eyes of Bad River families and tribal members, Jason's death will never be justified, according to tribal chairman Mike Wiggins.
That's just the way it is. In particular, the report is troublesome because it is a scrutiny and an analysis of Jason, when really, if you look at fentanyl as an issue, that's something that happened prior to the contact. Well, Brock Marjanovic and his decision making on cover and distance and how he approached that whole scenario was prior to contact, and that matters because when you respond to a man with a knife call and there's the man who fits the description of the 911 call and you drive up on said person within close proximity, you create a scenario that is possibly a deadly force situation when he had every opportunity to stop his car, create distance, take cover, and address Jason safely. Now, those types of things on the officer action side of the coin aren't given the scrutiny and the analysis compared to the way they're putting Jason out there. It's very hard to see, and you know what's happening to our community is happening all over the nation, and I can tell you that it's not a phenomenon, it's not a trend, it's a one-time incident. It's a subjective, life-changing thing for every community that and every family that's got to experience it, and it's got to stop. It's dramatic. I'll be the first to say there are deadly force scenarios that occur in law enforcement contexts. This doesn't rise to that type of scenario in my mind, and you know, so it's difficult to reconcile.
The sheriff put out a statement saying that he's aware of how this has broken trust between the tribe and law enforcement and wants to restore that.
You know, we face a reality that is such that we need our law enforcement personnel. We need a law enforcement presence in our community. At the same time, what's happening right now with Ashland County and the tribe is difficult, and there are issues that really have to be scrutinized and looked at. How we come to a cooperative agreement with the county sheriff is being completely reassessed and looked at. Things like the segregated data and getting statistics that are racially based so that we can see as a tribe how our people are being treated and how our people are being processed. And as importantly, the sheriff will be able to see how our people are being treated and being processed by the adjudication and law enforcement procedures. You know, that desegregated data is the first start to seeing disproportionalities. Disproportionalities are the first start to recognizing where you need to get to work. And whether that's community policing, cultural sensitivity training, whether that's replacing personnel. I mean, there's a whole list of things that we have to step up and really get aggressive on in terms of our relationship with the sheriff and Ashland County Sheriff's Department.
Do you want want to see happen next in the immediate future?
I want to see the federal request to the DOJ that we put out as a tribe honored, and I want to see an autonomous review by the feds. I want to, in that letter that we sent, were questions about the level of training, about the level of response, judgment decisions, I won't say level of response, I'll say the appropriateness of his judgment calls in that response. And you know, we want that autonomous review in addition to what's already been put out.
Anything else I haven't asked you that you want to say?
Just that it's a heartbreaking ordeal for our community, and coming together and standing together on a day like today is a form of healing. I recognize that there are many officers in the area who are doing their very best to serve our community and with integrity and with as much as an open heart as law enforcement can carry in some of the situations they got to get in. Nonetheless, this is just such a tough issue with our child here, and then it's also compounded by some of the other issues that we're dealing with as a tribe right now with the sheriff's department.
You mean like with the jail and the lawsuit there?
Yeah, with the lawsuit from the inmates who were, you know, sexually assaulted, and the follow-up on a homicide that happened in the fall has been very murky and slow, and you know, we've seen other incidents in other counties where the response, the apprehension, the charges, and all of that stuff were very quickly, and justice was being served. Ours is still kind of lagging, open-ended, and that's painful for a whole nother realm of families, you know, within our reservation. So we need justice in a lot of areas, and that makes it a very difficult time for us. But I want to acknowledge that there's good people out there doing their best, and I'm not looking to paint a broad brushstroke by any means. And I recognize too that law enforcement does many good things to help our community, and so it's just going to be a difficult journey forward that we gotta manage and stay on.
In this hour, we're talking about officer-involved shootings. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll hear about how the state has been handling these cases with Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Through the end of last year, Wisconsin had investigated 75 incidents regarding law enforcement since spring of 2014. It was then that the state passed a law requiring agencies to conduct an outside review of officer-involved shootings. Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel spoke with me by phone recently about how the state reviews those cases.
Many law enforcement agencies were doing this type of thing before, where they had outside agencies stepping in, but the law added a few extra layers of protection. There is no case where it's more important that the public have confidence in the outcome than in a case where law enforcement utilizes deadly force. We have to make sure that the public sees transparently what happened when the investigation's done, but then they look at it and they feel that there wasn't a cover-up. There wasn't something that someone tried to hide or someone tried to protect someone, that the public got to see the truth. In the vast majority of law enforcement use of deadly force cases, it turns out to be a justified use of deadly force. But you need the public to believe that that's the truth. And so that's why we work so hard for transparency in these. And we have to move fast. Go back a couple years ago, and these investigations seemed to drag on forever. We've made a commitment at DOJ that we're going to get these things done in 30 days. Sometimes it take a little bit longer, but when it does, if it's going to take 40 days, I want an explanation for why, and that better makes sense. But oftentimes we're doing it in under a month where we can turn these reports over to the DA so they can review it, make a decision based on a complete investigation. These things are critically important. The public needs to know that these are thorough, transparent investigations.
Well, and on that note of public confidence in what you're doing then, you know, there seems to have been a lot of criticism of law enforcement for how they handle these situations, including one that happened late last year where a northern Wisconsin deputy shot and killed a 14-year-old boy on a reservation. And training comes up a lot. Do you think officers need more training? And if so, what would that look like?
We provide tremendous training to law enforcement officers these days. It is very different than when I started as a prosecutor in 1990. The degree of education and training provided to officers is exponentially higher. We are always working to refine that, but it's difficult to train an officer to be prepared for every circumstance. You have to train some basic tenets. And you know, there's criticism sometimes that, you know, the officer killed someone and it turns out that the individual had what was a fake gun or a toy gun. The officer can't know that. Oftentimes, if the person has a gun that looks like a real gun, that officer has to presume it is a real gun, and they can be criticized in hindsight that you got it wrong, but that's not the test for the officer. The test is whether they acted reasonably, and it's the same. That is the same self-defense test that's applied to any citizen. If someone comes into your home and is attacking your family, if you believe that use of force is necessary to prevent harm to your family, you're entitled to do it. That's the same, and it's based on whether you're reasonable, not whether, in hindsight or Monday morning quarterbacking, you're right. It's whether at the time your decision was reasonable.
Well, and in the last year, you've come out with this guidebook for investigators doing outside reviews of these shootings. So, I mean, with this guidebook that you've established, how do you find that that's working? Are you constantly kind of looking at where things are and reviewing that?
We're always monitoring it, but we haven't had large-scale changes that we've made to it because it wasn't something that was produced overnight. This was the result of consulting our agents who had done, for many of them, many, many investigations like this, where we took their expertise and then we looked at the public confidence side of it and reflected on you've got to utilize the things that are best designed to get to a truthful rendition of the events that occurred. And you've got to do it in a way that the public has confidence that this is the truth about what happened, as best we can know it. Some things you'll never know, but we have to discern things as best we can. So the policy is working well, and we'll always be monitoring that to see if there are issues. There are things that sometimes in the way we conduct the investigation that local law enforcement won't like, but those things are designed to make sure the public is confident in the outcome, like that we won't let, in most circumstances, the supervisory staff sit in on our initial interviews with the officers who are involved, because we don't want to create a sense that there's a conflict. It's not that we think that the local supervisor will do something improper during the course of the interview. It's that we don't want the public thinking that we were in cahoots with the officer that was involved in use of force. And it's important to that officer, too. And generally, the law enforcement understands that their department has to continue to provide public safety in their community. And therefore, confidence in the outcome is critically important to their department.
Well, do you think the public has a good idea of what law enforcement does and what they encounter and the standards that they're held to?
Well, those things aren't secrets. The nature of the training we provide, we're not going to share with the public our tactics. How do you take take down a suspect who you believe is armed. We're not going to teach them that because we don't want that. That could endanger the officer. But in terms of the general themes we have in how an officer should go about making sure they and the community they serve are safe, those general themes are not things that are secretive. We train the officer that reaction can't beat action, meaning if you're reacting to someone else's steps to cause harm to you, you're going to be behind them. And when you're talking about the use of a gun, for instance, if they get the jump on you, as they would say in the Old West, you're going to lose that fight. Therefore, that officer has to be prepared to not just be reacting, but be ready to be proactive in protecting their safety and the people they've sworn to serve.
Again, you are listening to Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel about the state's process for reviewing officer-involved shootings. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll talk with University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris about how the courts have weighed in on officer-involved shootings. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next guest is David Harris. He is professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He's also host of the Criminal and Justice podcast and author of several books, including Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing. Harris spoke with me by Skype earlier this week about how officer-involved shootings are treated under the law.
Any officer-involved shooting is considered a use of force, and uses of force by police are governed first and foremost by the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution. The Fourth Amendment is the search and seizure amendment that you might be familiar with. We think of it as the governing principles for search warrants, but it is also about arrests and arrest warrants. And a use of force is considered kind of the ultimate type of seizure of a person. And use of deadly force, the ultimate sort of seizure. When you use deadly force on somebody, you seize them entirely and maybe even take their life. So Fourth Amendment standards have for decades been the basic governing principles to measure use of force by our police.
And what have we seen, you know, in recent years? I think the Michael Brown incident that kind of spurred all of this discussion about use of force in Ferguson. What have we seen then as communities have begun to ask questions about how law enforcement is treated and what's appropriate?
Sure. The basic law was laid down in two Supreme Court cases in the 1980s, Tennessee versus Garner and Connor versus Graham. And what those two cases said was that use of force, and especially use of deadly force, is governed by a rule of reasonableness in which police officers have to be viewed in the context of their actions. And they can use only as much force as is reasonably, objectively necessary. That leaves a lot of room for interpretation. And it has tended for many years to favor police in the sense that the court is instructing lower courts and jurors to avoid second-guessing to police and to see them in the context to which they testify. Are they afraid? Do they think there was mortal danger to them? When we get into the 2000s, and especially to 2014 with the incident in Ferguson, Missouri, in which Michael Brown was killed by a police officer, up until that point, these incidents, while they had occurred in the thousands around the country for years, were always viewed as a kind of one-off local issue, a local incident in which a person had ended up shot or even dead at the hands of police, that there were extenuating circumstances of one type or another, and usually, though not always, usually that the officer was justified in shooting because of something that the victim had said or done or not done, such as put down a weapon. What they were not seen as was a part of a connected national problem. And that's really what changed with Ferguson. All of a sudden, people everywhere began to see that this was not just a problem in Ferguson, Missouri, or in Pittsburgh, or in Wisconsin, but that these things happened everywhere all the time, and there were a common set of issues and problems that were tangled up in basically all of them. And the other thing that was noticed is that there was very little data on how often this happened. There was no national requirement that was followed that required police departments to give data to, say, the national government on all police-involved shootings. There were laws about it, but they were not followed. And with these two big realizations, the public began to look at these very, very differently and to say, we are not going to treat this as a local problem. We are not about to have cases just kind of slow walked through investigations that last forever until the coverage subsides and people forget. We are not forgetting. We are watching. We are going to demand accountability and look at it as a single sort of national problem. For the first time, you had data being collected on all police shootings per year. I believe the first year was 2015, maybe 2016, but not by government, by journalistic organizations, by The Guardian and The Washington Post. And it really gave us the first real picture of how many of these there were in a year. Was the problem getting worse? Were these shootings part of some larger racial picture or other kinds of influences? And so the fundamental lens through which we view these things really did change in 2014. And that's why we view them somewhat differently than we used to before.
Well, and I guess I want to go back to what you were saying about case law that gives favor to police in these types of shooting incidents. And I guess I'm wondering how these cases should be treated. I mean, when you're talking about something that is life-changing and happens in a matter of moments, what should be looked at as far as how the law enforcement officer or how police react in those circumstances and judging whether or not it was appropriate?
Yeah, so the law that came in the 80s, especially with the Graham versus Connor case, and I may have gotten the name of that case backwards before, with the law that was laid down in the 80s by the Supreme Court, it did give a lot of room and a lot of discretion to police judgment. Now, you may think that's appropriate, you may not, but what we know for sure is that it, as a Fourth Amendment standard, it is the basic required constitutional law. But states are free to make their own law that is more protective of their citizens than that. In other words, the Fourth Amendment forms the minimum standard, the floor, if you will. States can do more in terms of the standard to which they decide they will hold police officers when they use force. They can mandate their own tracking of uses of force. They can mandate their own kinds of training. They can put even tougher legal standards in place. Now, most of them do not, for reasons we can discuss if you like, but the Fourth Amendment standard only sets the floor. Now, when you go beyond that, what should the law be? I think there's a consensus, certainly outside law enforcement, that more is necessary than just the basic constitutional standard. Even inside law enforcement, there's a fair amount of discussion right now. The Police Executives Research Forum, or PERF, put out a paper almost 2 years ago, I think, in which they suggested a higher standard for law enforcement. That they suggested we shouldn't have shootings that were, quote, lawful but awful. And that's really what we have a lot of now. We have, you know, this may be a lawful shooting in any particular case according to the Fourth Amendment and the Supreme Court cases. But people look at it and they say, isn't there something else that could have been done? And so you've had a lot of organizations suggesting higher standards than the Constitution requires when it sets the minimum. Among the things that have been looked at have been, number one, the requirement to de-escalate. Number two, creating time and distance in an incident, if possible, as a form of de-escalation. So it's not only about lowering the tension in a particular situation, but backing up, giving the police officer physical distance, creating time for a situation to resolve with less than deadly force used. These are all ways of coping with this stuff. There are less than lethal weapons, things like tasers and pepper spray, that may or may not be appropriate in certain situations. There are discussions about more requirements for training in mental health intervention, so police officers have a better understanding when they're facing people in mental health crisis how to handle these things without resorting to use of force. So there is a lot of discussion about how to do this better. And clearly states can do more, cities can do more, individual police departments can do more than the basic minimum that the Constitution requires.
Well, and discussion about like de-escalation or mental health training and things along those lines, is that fairly new, or is that something that's been ongoing in law enforcement, or are we seeing more of an emphasis on that now?
It's not new. But there is much more of an emphasis on it now than there was before 2014. Particularly, the emphasis on mental health issues is not new. The standard in the industry for good mental health training for police officers is called CIT, Crisis Intervention Training. And this had its birth in, I believe, the city of Memphis years and years ago, around the 2000, if my memory serves correctly. So it's been around, but we've paid less attention to it in the past than it deserves. Right now, we see case after case, since this is all very visible, about people who are in mental health crisis. Somebody, it's often a family member, calls 911, asks for help, can't handle the person. Maybe the person is picking up objects or a weapon or getting threatening, whatever it is, needs help, and the police come. And if they are not correctly trained and schooled in what might be going on and how best to address it, things can get out of hand in a very deadly way very quickly, and people die. So that kind of training can actually save lives and help police deal with these difficult situations much more effectively. I mean, it would be best if we could call 911 and we would get mental health workers out on scene. But let's face it, the police are the ones who are going to respond. The de-escalation training has also been around in different forms for years, but it is now newly emphasized as we look for ways to avoid using deadly force. When we look at the statistics and we see that 1,000 people every year are killed by police officers, I mean, that's a high number. It's not necessarily that it's getting worse, but it's a large number. Most of them are legally justified, for sure. But what if we could avoid much of that? That number is proportionally very high, and proportionally higher than almost any other Western industrialized country. And so de-escalation training, if done correctly and emphasized properly, can save lives.
Well, how much does staffing and resources play a role in this? Because I feel like I was looking at a law enforcement organization's website, and they cited some of the top issues for this coming year continue to be staffing and funding. So, I mean, are we seeing issues related to this because agencies aren't able to afford the kind of training or professional development that they may want to offer their officers on these types of things like crisis intervention training?
Oh, it's a huge issue. This is a very, very important point. You know, when we think of police agencies in America, we think of the Milwaukee Police Department, the Chicago Police Department, the NYPD. These are large agencies, New York especially. But most police departments in the United States are less than 50 in number of sworn personnel, and a great number of them are less than 10. And when you have police departments that are that size, just sparing a person for 40 hours of training, that requires that you have the resources and the people to actually go out and cover your jurisdiction. So it is first and foremost a question of manpower, then resources. You're going to have to send these people to school for some of this. You're going to have to get them training. You're going to have to bring that training in, whatever it is. That costs money. It's not free. And we would be making very good investments in our police departments if we gave them more and the right kinds of training in order so that they could do the job that we want them to do the way we want them to do it. In many of these police departments, the pay is poor. They're really stretched in terms of the amount of hours worked, what they have to do, the distances they're expected to cover. In a certain respect, if we're not willing as taxpayers to support our police the way that we want them to be, we shouldn't be surprised if they can't be all those things for us.
Well, and what about some of the other challenges that law enforcement may be facing? I mean, we've seen the opioid epidemic just spread across the country and affect almost every community. What are some of the challenges that law enforcement are confronting in being able to respond to some of these calls that may be life-threatening for either the person calling or for the officer responding?
Well, it's a great strain on their personnel and their resources. I don't know what that particular problem is like in the area in which this case occurred, but in the area I live in, southwestern Pennsylvania, and we're next door to West Virginia and Ohio, I mean, these places are ground zero for some of the worst opioid abuse. And it's taken a toll on first responders. Police, yes, but other first responders, too. It's stretching them thin, sometimes to the breaking point. And it really makes you wonder how we're supposed to continue just the response aspect of this. Put aside the huge issues of why people are doing it, the inability of most folks to get comprehensive kinds of drug treatment, all of that, those are big, big issues. But put that aside for the moment and just think about the first responders. The police are certainly part of that picture, and to the extent that they're having to pick that load up in their jurisdictions, it is just an additional set of responsibilities and stresses.
So what types of things or solutions are being proposed to try and prevent, as you said before, lawful but awful incidents where officers are involved and either injury or death occurs?
Well, there's a couple of things I guess I want to say before getting to that point. I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk about this because I saw it in one of the articles you sent me. I think when there's a shooting like this, there is a strong tendency, certainly on the part of people who are closest to the deceased, you want to know, couldn't something else have been done? And often I see the suggestion that the police officer should have or could have used a taser or pepper spray or something like that. It's important to understand the place of those weapons. And they are weapons. There's no question about that. I've written about this. I've been tased purposely, not because I was misbehaving somewhere. And I sat on a commission about the taser use. What people don't understand about tasers and those sorts of weapons is that they are not appropriate to respond to deadly threats. Okay, if you are truly facing a deadly threat, as in somebody pointing a gun at you, or as in this instance, at least if we believe the reports, somebody with a knife who is advancing toward you and won't drop it and may be lunging toward you, it is not appropriate to use a taser because there is no guarantee at all that the taser will work and stop the deadly threat. Police training is all centered in terms of responding to deadly threats around the idea that you have to stop the threat. And a taser or pepper spray, while it would stop me, I can tell you that because I've been through it, it won't necessarily stop somebody else who's very determined or maybe who has undergone that unpleasant experience before. Different people might have different abilities to ignore that kind of pain, to overcome it. And you also have the issue of the taser not connecting correctly. It also has a very limited effective area. The wires that it uses are only 25 feet long. They both, the probes on both pieces of wire have to stick to the extent that they make contact with the person's skin. So the idea that if he had a taser, he should have used that first, you know, I feel for the people who are saying that, but it's just not correct. That is not the appropriate response, assuming you have somebody charging at you with a deadly weapon. If that is true, the training is all to the contrary. You respond to deadly threats with deadly force that can stop the threat. That's how it's done. That's the only way that the police and the public could be safe if they're truly facing that situation. So let me now answer your question, sort of what can be done in a situation like this. I guess I would return to the two points I made earlier, framing de-escalation through verbal training, through time and distance training, as one of the key responses where appropriate. Transparency is incredibly appropriate. When something like this happens, you want to be as transparent as possible. Get all the information out to people as soon as possible. This has more to do with how people respond to an incident after it happens. But we know when a police department puts everything out there that it can, including videos when appropriate and allowed, not so much information that it would compromise the case, of course, but enough so that people can really understand what happened. It's much more helpful to the public than holding back. When you talk about these sorts of uses of force, you want to make sure that the type of policing you're doing in an overall sense minimizes the number of times that you're going to have a use of force encounter. All right. So you want to build relationships. You want to build trust with your communities as much as you can in advance of anything going wrong, so that when you have a problem, there's a better chance that you might actually know that person in the small town that you're encountering. You might actually have some idea of whether this is a person whose word you can take in a report when you get it. All of these things are very, very important to policing that can be better. Another thing to think about is to, in your policies and in your various sorts of training, you train for the idea that saving life is paramount. Okay. Now this, I know this should be obvious, but you can see in a dozen videos you can bring up with a couple of clicks that doesn't always seem to be the highest value. And I'm not saying anything about this particular police department when I say this, but in so many of these incidents, the idea is that, well, if there's any kind of a threat, we got to neutralize the threat first. Think about ways to preserve this person's life later. Those two things should at the very worst be hand in hand. And then when you think about what happens after the person has been shot, in many of these situations, there's no effort or very little effort to summon medical attention, to do things like that. And then you want, I think, to have as parts of your policy and your training that use of force is to be the last resort. It's a tool in the toolbox, and sometimes it can't be avoided. And that to say it's the last resort does not mean that you would never turn to it right away. Sometimes a situation a police officer might face requires it off the top. You don't have other options. But if there are other options, you got to take them.
Well, and there was one other thing I neglected to mention before, which is how a lot of these incidents have drawn up discussion over implicit bias among law enforcement or racial bias. You know, one of the things that we've seen come about from the shooting here in northern Wisconsin is that a lot of people are beginning to talk now about what they view as systemic racism. What do you see or how is that being dealt with across the country? And is that a fair assertion to make against law enforcement?
It's a fair assertion to make against our society as a whole. Most of us, according to the best information we have, the best research, do harbor implicit unconscious biases favoring whites over people of color. That's just a fact. And this has been determined through the use of the implicit association test at Harvard, administered millions upon millions of times, and other kinds of testing. That doesn't mean that we are all Archie Bunker racists, or that we even act upon all of our implicit biases all the time. What it does mean is that since police are drawn from the general population, they're likely to start in the same place as all the rest of us. And then as time goes on, their experiences may lead them to draw unfortunate, human, but unfortunate conclusions based on the few people that they might see in any given day in bad situations, if they are patrolling certain neighborhoods where there's a lot of crime. So this can be a factor in policing and in human relations generally. So remember, it's not a police problem first and foremost, it's a human problem. Are there ways to deal with this? Yes. It's not clear that you can train bias out of people, that you can de-bias people. I think the evidence doesn't support that idea. But what you can do is give police training that makes them aware of potential biases and explains to them how that can affect their behavior on the job, even if they're not aware of it. And even if they would straight up tell you sincerely and be truthful about the fact that they have strict egalitarian beliefs. The nature of implicit bias is that it's there, even in people with those beliefs. So what you can do by making people aware of it, you can suggest to them certain kinds of interventions that they can incorporate in their training and in their ways of doing their job that will help them to avoid the impacts on behavior. Because that's really what we fear. I mean, you know, what's in somebody's mind is in somebody's mind. What we don't want is for it to come out in their behavior. And when you're a police officer with the responsibilities and power that you have, that can be quite, quite dangerous. There's no hard and fast, scientifically proven connection between having implicit biases and particular behaviors. You need more information than just, I am implicitly biased against black people, to know if that would actually make you do something. But to be aware of it as a first step through training is certainly the most important thing. And then there are, as I said, those kinds of interventions. What you know, I mean, if I was up there, I don't know your particular community or your demography, that you do have a Native American reservation there. And I know that there are Native American populations throughout northern Wisconsin. I also remember from some of my early work up there that Wisconsin had among the largest racial disparities in its prison system, I think right behind Minnesota. It wasn't a matter of the people of Wisconsin being bad or something. It was just a problem, I think, that people were not aware of. And so if I was up there and I was asked for a recommendation, I would say, you need somebody to come up there and explain or to take advantage of local resources, because I'm sure there are colleges and people who study this, to explain what this is and how it can affect behavior and to suggest ways that this can be countered, not erased because we're human beings, but countered so that it doesn't affect policing going forward. One of the most important things they could do would be to collect data of various kinds on police-citizen encounters, not just shootings either, but all kinds, pedestrian stops, traffic stops, other kinds of enforcement actions, good, solid data under the supervision of some kind of unaffiliated partner that would give them a real picture of how cases like this are handled, not just on the police level, but well into the court system as well.
Again, that was David Harris, law professor at the University of Pittsburgh and author of Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing. You can check out his podcast, Criminal Injustice, on iTunes. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. And you can find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.